This is VOA News, via remote. I'm Coral Bowman. At least 10 people have been killed as Typhoon Goni pounds the Philippines on Sunday, tearing off roofs, toppling power lines, and causing flooding. The strongest typhoon of the year also caused deadly landslides that buried a number of houses in the southern part of the island of Luzon, officials said. Goni was a super typhoon when it made landfall on Catanduanes Island before dawn, packing maximum sustained winds of 225 kilometers per hour. It was downgraded a few hours later as it swept across Luzon and reduced intensity as it headed towards the capital, Manila, where the city of 12 million braced for strong winds. Goni comes a week after Typhoon Molave hit the same region of the natural disaster-prone archipelago, killing 22 people. Rescue workers were searching 8 wrecked buildings in Izmir, Turkey on Sunday as hopes dwindled for survivors and the death toll from a powerful earthquake that hit the western part of the country rose to 58. The quake, measuring 7.0 in magnitude, also injured 930 people. The Turkish Emergency Authority said nearly 6,000 rescue workers have been working day and night since it hit on Friday. Overnight, 33 hours after the earthquake, a 70-year-old man was pulled from rubble to the applause of onlookers. Turkey has reported more than 800 aftershocks following the quake, including 40 that were above 4 in magnitude. The last earthquake in Turkey, measuring above 7 in magnitude, was in 1999 and killed 17,000 people. Since then, tougher rules have been placed on building safety. For more on these and other stories making international news headlines, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Voters in ex-Soviet Moldova also went to the polls on Sunday to elect a president under the watchful eye of Moscow, which wants the country to remain closed. The pro-Moscow president is seeking a new 4-year mandate, with his biggest challenge coming from a longtime pro-Western rival who wants Moldova to join the European Union. Experts predict a second-round runoff on November 15th, as neither candidate is expected to secure an outright majority on Sunday. The country of 3.5 million people has long been divided between those favoring closer ties with the EU and those who cling to Soviet-era relations with Russia. Although part of the Soviet Union until its collapse in 1991, the small country between Ukraine and Romania has close historic ties with Romania, and its main language is Romanian. Polls opened in Algeria Sunday for a vote on a revised constitution the regime hopes will neutralize a protest movement which last year drove the country's longtime president from power. The current president has pitched the revisions as meeting the demands of a youth-led protest movement that staged huge demonstrations until the coronavirus pandemic shut them down. But observers say the fresh document doesn't offer much that's new. State media has promoted calls for a yes vote, while those supporting a no vote have been banned from holding meetings, said one 78-year-old voter, "I voted yes so that my country doesn't collapse." The youth movement has urged voters to boycott the poll. Algeria, with a population of 44 million people and vast oil reserves, has been battered by low crude prices and the coronavirus pandemic, further hurting a young population already suffering from unemployment. And U.S. President Donald Trump visits 5 swing states Sunday in a weekend sprint against challenger Joe Biden just 2 days before the U.S. presidential election. The candidates campaigned in crucial states in the Midwest and Southeast on Saturday. Mr. Trump rallies voters Sunday in toss-up states Michigan, Iowa, North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, while Biden focuses on Pennsylvania, a key battleground likely to play an important role in Tuesday's election. Underscoring the high stakes and the disruptive impact of the coronavirus pandemic, a record 92 million early votes have already been cast in what is looking to be the biggest voter turnout in American history. Again, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We call for the regional bodies, SADC, East Africa Community, Africa Union, all to not recognize the Magufuli regime, and also call for rerun of the election.
Tanzanian opposition parties demand fresh polls after rejecting the results of last week's general election.
Election campaign that targets all stakeholders and calls on them to ensure that they follow the guidelines for the campaign, because at the end of it, we want a successful exercise and safe participation and high turnout.
The Ugandan Electoral Commission plans to accept nomination applications from presidential candidates beginning Monday.
I'm going to put my head on the chopping board. Let it be. People are calling me, no, be careful, these people are thugs. Thugs for what? Who's not going to die? Can we fetch something for our children? My son has got a lousy mother. What should I do with him?
And a Zambian journalist demands the firing of Information Minister Dora Silia over allegations of disparaging ethnocentric remarks. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tanzania's main opposition parties are calling on the international community, including regional and continental African organizations, not to recognize the outcome of the just concluded elections. In a joint statement, main opposition party Chadema and ACT Wazalendo rejected the results and demanded a rerun of the polls. The parties also demanded the establishment of an independent electoral commission to organize fresh polls. Their remarks come after the National Electoral Commission declared incumbent President John Magufuli winner of the presidential poll with 84% of the total vote cast. His main rival, Tundu Lissu, was a distant second with 13% of the vote. Emmanuel Mvula is the campaign manager for the opposition party ACT Wazalendo. He tells me that the two major parties have called for peaceful protests beginning Monday. He says that the demonstration will continue until their demands for fresh elections are met.
The two political parties, ACT Wazalendo and Chadema, today has called for not recognizing what was termed as election, because it was not an election. It didn't meet the standards for the whole exercise to be called an election. And therefore, they called for the rerun of the election and a new electoral commission to be established. Also have called for demonstrations starting Monday and unending demonstrations. The other thing is that we, for instance, ACT Wazalendo has won in 4 parliamentary seats, Chadema 1, and that we term the seats as the proceeds of crime. And our candidates, the ones who have been elected, won't take the position.
But if you are calling for fresh elections at the same time calling for protest on Monday, don't you think that there could be a possible backlash from the government and that the security agencies might not necessarily allow it, since some people might say it could turn violent?
We have called for peaceful demonstrations, so we don't see how it is going to turn violent. We do not condone violence. And people have their rights to demonstrate. And people are demanding for their rights to elect their leaders. So I don't see the fear that this demonstration will be violent. Unless the state and state apparatus like the police and the army are going to turn them violently unnecessary.
But Emmanuel, realistically, do you think the Electoral Commission will adhere to your call or your demand for fresh elections to organize yet another election. Do you see that happening?
We see that happening. We see that happening, and we won't get out of the streets until that has happened.
And do you think that is feasible? Because the CCM supporters are saying that Tanzanian voters voted overwhelmingly to give President Magufuli a second term and overwhelmingly voted also for representatives of CCM across the country. They won by a landslide, they say. So why should they organize?
Who told you that? We have evidence open to everyone to see that the election was rigged. There was stuffing of ballots. So who said that they won in landslide? Maybe if they want to say that they stole this election in landslide, maybe that should be a term. But not that they've won in landslide. We have evidences for everyone to see, and it's not contestable. Let me tell you one thing. A day before election, Tundu Lissu said publicly that these people are going to steal the vote. The information we have that they have 12 million votes, and that is what happened. And you can see even in the tallying how discrepancies are in numbers. So who said that they've won? Evidence is here, and I don't think if a right-minded person will question whether this election was free and fair or not.
Emmanuel, some people are suggesting that if you say you have the evidence, uncontested evidence that showed massive rigging as you claim, why don't you go to the court?
The law in Tanzania doesn't allow that. The law in Tanzania does not allow the presidential elections, the results, to be contested in any court of law. So the only court available is the court of the people, and that is where we are taking these matters to. And it has been so decided by the organs of the party. So anyone who is ready to join, we are welcoming. We call for the regional bodies, SADC, East Africa Community, Africa Union, all to not to recognize the Magufuli regime, and also call for a rerun of the election.
Emmanuel Mvula is the campaign manager for the opposition party ACT Wazalendo. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The Ugandan Electoral Commission plans to accept nomination applications from presidential candidates beginning Monday. Officials say the applications form part of the commission's effort to organize next year's general election. Ugandans are scheduled to go to the polls next year to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives. Incumbent President Yoweri Museveni will be seeking another term in office. He is expected to be challenged by Patrick Oboi Amuriat from the main opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He'll also be running against parliamentarian and popular musician Robert Chiagulanyi, also known as Bobby Wine, from the National Unity Platform, or NUP. To learn more about the Electoral Commission's application process for presidential candidates, I reach Patrick Bukenya, a spokesperson for the Ugandan Electoral Commission.
Monday 2nd and Tuesday 3rd November, the Electoral Commission will be receiving from aspiring candidates, their credentials, their nomination form, and all accompanying for purposes of nomination for the presidential election 2021. This exercise will be for 2 days here at Chambogo University, just outside Kampala, capital city.
What are the requirements for the aspiring candidate to meet the threshold that the Electoral Commission has set for them?
Well, the Presidential Elections Act requires candidates for presidential elections to fulfill some requirements, yes, and that includes them being a registered voter, and of course that means you are seniors and above and a citizen of Uganda. Then they are required to provide proof that they have gotten support or endorsement of the citizens of Uganda and who are registered voters from districts which make two-thirds of all the districts of Uganda. In Uganda, we have 146 districts and cities, and so they are required to provide proof of voters who have supported their candidature from 98 districts. And so far, We have 10 aspiring candidates who have submitted signatures which have been verified. They are also required to pay a nomination fee of Uganda shillings 20 million. So they'll be required to provide proof that they have paid that money in the bank and have gotten a receipt to show that they've paid. Of course, if someone has been sponsored by a political party, we will request proof to show us that they are the flag bearers of the political party. So a letter from the Secretary General of the political party to that effect. Then, of course, they will have to meet a minimum academic requirement of advanced level, which is a standard in Uganda, a minimum standard for contesting for this position.
Due to the COVID-19 movement restrictions and plans to contain the spread of the disease, I understand the Electoral Commission has imposed new ways of campaign in the run-up to next year's election. What is different this time in terms of the measures you've implemented to curtail or stop the spread of the coronavirus as political activities continue for next year's election?
For example, during nomination, we will not allow big groups to come here at our center. We will be allowing aspiring candidates to come with only 10 supporters. And today we opened up our offices to provide free COVID-19 testing because we want them to also test for COVID-19. But during the campaign, and we have advised and given guidelines that we use as much as possible low human-to-human contact method, which means meetings involving a smaller number of people. And then we've also advised to use a lot of non-contact methods like, you know, media, where you can reach the electorate remotely. And an announcement on radio, an announcement on TV for those who can do that. And also there's what we call one-on-one and door-to-door campaigning for local government councils. It's always used so much. And then, of course, we've also asked the candidates to rely so much on the new media, that social media like Facebook, many are using WhatsApp or sending out videos, and, of course, using the cell, the mobile phone, to reach audiences through short messages, SMS, and then voice messages. So we are using a mixture of approaches which are meant to replace the mass public rallies, which at the moment are not permitted.
How is the Electoral Commission going to engage stakeholders as well as these political parties to address their concerns before the elections? Because they routinely accuse the Electoral Commission of bias and favoring the ruling party when it organizes elections.
We are going to be holding on a regular basis consultative meetings with the nominated candidates, because now we know them, for example, at parliamentary and local government, and now we are going to presidential. We plan to regularly engage with them and ensure that they comply. But we also are doing a education campaign that targets all stakeholders and calls on them to ensure that they follow the guidelines for the campaign, because at the end of it, we want a successful exercise and safe participation and high turnout.
Patrick Bukenya is a spokesperson for the Ugandan Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Terumo Blood and Cell Technology, or TBCT, a global leader in blood management, plans with its partners to establish a working group to help ensure adequate, safe, and sustainable blood in sub-Saharan Africa. The group will begin operating November 10. The establishment of the group follows a series of activities in 2019 led by Terumo BCT at the UN General Assembly and Africa Health Business Summit on the importance of blood to health in Africa. This after health experts expressed concern about the challenges the continent faces in blood collection. They also say the COVID-19 pandemic has further reduced blood donations due to what they say are mistaken notions around the transmission of the virus. To learn more about the program aimed at driving advocacy for adequate, safe, and sustainable blood in sub-Saharan Africa, I reach Filana Mugenyi, the Government Affairs Manager for Sub-Saharan Africa at Terumo BCT.
The Coalition on Blood for Africa is actually the realization and the culmination of a growing consensus that the agenda for adequate, safe, and sustainable blood in Africa requires a multi-stakeholder, multi-pronged, and innovative approach to make meaningful impact. And this was born out of a series of events we had over last year, including one that I think we discussed, the panel we had with the Organization of First Ladies for Development in Africa. And we had panelists from the World Health Organization, to Ministers of Health, to the Global Blood Fund, and everyone agreed that something needed to be done around blood. And at Kerumo, we're extremely proud to be the pioneers and convenings of this very important coalition, which is actually the first and only platform dedicated to crowding in and bringing together people, resources, and ideas to really move the needle on blood and blood safety across sub-Saharan Africa.
So why do you think there is a significant blood shortage across sub-Saharan Africa?
Some of the reasons are because of an over-reliance on school children to actually donate blood. And of course, when the children graduate, they don't come back as regular voluntary adult donors. And in some African countries, we rely on students for 80% of our blood, so it's not really sustainable. There are other challenges like being able to transport the blood across the whole of Africa. There are some challenges related to stigmatization and superstition and taboo around donating blood. In some cases, although it's not really such a big issue anymore, there are concerns around safely donating blood. And then, of course, because blood is not really seen as a big priority in most public health systems, it doesn't receive the resources, the investment, and the policy that it should have. And so it's almost a neglected public health area.
On November 10th, with regards to the working group your organization seeks to establish, what are the core areas that the group seeks to address?
So everybody has an important role to play. And the objectives of this group reflect that, because there's three main areas we're going to be looking at. One is reflection, where we'll be looking at research, policy analysis, and data collection. And the aim of this will be to help policymakers make informed, evidence-based decisions around blood in Africa. The second thing we're going to be focused on is dialogue, having debates, awareness raising, discussions like the one you and I are having now to raise awareness on the importance of blood and create a platform and an environment where stakeholders can freely discuss how important it is and how we can work together to overcome challenges around blood and blood safety. And finally, we're also going to have action. And this includes technical assistance, capacity building, designing and implementing programs that can really help us move the needle around blood in Africa. And we think that with these three kind of pillars, we'll be able to have a multi-pronged innovative approach to really address this challenge across all fronts.
So what are the expected impact, or what do you seek to achieve with this drive?
Part of the objectives we designed are to ensure if we do all these things properly, if we do more research, if we have more awareness, technical assistance, and investment in blood, then we are going to meet our objective of collecting enough blood, having a sustained supply of blood, and ensuring that blood is safe for all Africans. What we see in the immediate term is we need to raise awareness on the fact that blood is an essential medicine as defined by the World Health Organization. And whatever our objectives are in Africa from a health perspective, whether it's to treat sickle cell disease, whether it's to treat cancer, whether it's to treat maternal bleeding, whether it's to treat trauma patients, all of those require blood. So if we're able to achieve that, not only will we save lives, we're also going to make our health system delivery much more efficient across the continent.
Filana Mugenyi is the Government Affairs Manager for Sub-Saharan Africa at the Terumo BCT. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. An investigative journalist is calling on Zambian President Edgar Lungu to fire Information Minister Dora Celia. Thomas Alans Gambo accuses the cabinet minister of disparaging an ethnic group in a recently leaked audio tape recording. Ms. Celia, who is also a parliamentarian, is alleged to have made the disparaging comment against the Tonga ethnic group in recent remarks made in Eastern Province. Zgambu has also petitioned the police to launch an investigation, saying the pronouncement of the minister could create tension and disunity. It is the first time a cabinet minister or parliamentarian has been reported to the police for an investigation over ethnocentric disparaging remarks. Some Zambians say the minister is unlikely to be fired or investigated by the police. But Thomas Alan Zgambu tells me that if authorities fail to launch an investigation against the minister, he will file a legal petition in court.
I'm not Tonga, Peter, but I've got a son with a lawswoman. So I'm an Easterner. I come from a province where the president comes from. I come from a province where the current Minister of Information comes from. But I feel they are playing very divisive politics. Let them talk about issues, not tribe. I felt so offended when I heard the audio, but the pressure has been building in me. And I just wanted the posterity to judge me correctly. This is one Zambia, one nation. We are 73 tribes in Zambia.
Thomas, have you presented the evidence to the police to enable them begin an investigation? Because some people may argue that the audio might have been doctored.
Zambia has been in election mode for a long time, from the time President Saka died, elections after elections. There are so many recordings, some from the opposition. This is an audio which she uttered the words. So I've presented the evidence. If they want to dispute the evidence in court, let them dispute in court. But at least let them arrest the minister. Let them take the minister to court. And then let her lawyers, if she has to be represented by government lawyers, let them dispute the recording.
This is unprecedented because no formal complaint has ever been made against a member of parliament or, for that matter, a cabinet minister regarding hate speech, which is illegal in Zambia. Do you think that the police will act on this? Because some Zambians I spoke with are doubtful that anything of such will happen.
Peter, there's always the first time. What if the police acts on it? It's the first time that an ordinary citizen has lodged a complaint. It has happened. I have. If the police do not act on it, I'll test the integrity and credibility of the judiciary. I'll go for private prosecution. I'll lodge in a complaint with a magistrate, direct, without using the police. So I'll go to the magistrate court and lodge in a complaint. I'll hire a lawyer or I'll represent myself. I don't have money. I don't want even any political party to hijack this thing. No, it's coming from my heart as a Zambian. So if I don't have enough money, I will represent myself.
Some Zambians are also calling on President Edgar Lungu to fire the cabinet minister, Dora Celia. However, some people are saying that she has to be given the opportunity to explain herself. What do you say to that?
I respect President Lungu. I'm a patriot. For me, even if the letter I've lodged in talks too much about Dora Celia, President Lungu should also fire these other ministers.
So what time are you giving the police to act on your petition of complaint against Ms. Dora Celia, the information minister?
I did not give them a time frame. I did not, but I've given myself a time frame. But I can tell you, I think by Monday, I would want something to happen. They are very swift on other people. They are very swift. I'm an investigative journalist. I help the government of the day, but this is just too much. So if they don't, the police don't act by Monday, okay? Tuesday, I'm going to lodge in a complaint with a magistrate, Lusaka magistrate. If they throw it away, I've tested the judiciary. Time change, seasons change, the weather changes. One day, someone will say, yes, there's someone who attempted to do this. This is too much. This is one Zambia, one nation. Tongas, Bembas, Lozis, we are one. 73 tribes who have intermarried. Okay? I have a niece who is Tonga. Okay? I have a niece who is Bemba. I have a brother who is married to a Bemba. I have a sister who is married to a Tonga. What is this nonsense? It should end. And if I'm going to put my head on the chopping board, let it be. People are calling me, no, be careful, these people are thugs. Thugs for what? Who's not going to die? Can we set something for our children? My son has got a lousy mother. What should I do with him?
Thomas Alan Zgambo is a Zambian investigative journalist. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, investment arms of the U.S. government are pouring tens of billions of dollars into African economies through private investment initiatives, which represent a drastic shift from the old model of development aid. But do these splashy programs make a difference? VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
How big is the U.S.'s commitment to Africa? Let us count the ways, says Victoria Whitney, chief operating officer of the Prosper Africa Initiative, launched in 2018. In the past year, she said, the initiative, which spans 17 U.S. government agencies, has facilitated more than $22 billion worth of deals in more than 30 African countries, with agreements focusing on small and medium-sized African businesses. This week, she announced new measures that aim to harness private U.S. investment and pour it into African entrepreneurship.
This new continent-wide program is going to provide a really wide range of services. Think business consulting and transaction facilitation, targeted policy interventions, really the core tenets of the Prosper Africa Initiative, and is expected to deliver billions more dollars in exports and investment and create hundreds of thousands of jobs by 2026. I really think this new program is going to be a game changer.
Prosper Africa is one of the many U.S. government initiatives aimed at bringing private investment into the continent. The International Development Finance Corporation is the federal government's development finance institution. It works on financing private development projects in lower and middle-income countries. Since its launch at the beginning of 2020, it has invested more than $8 billion in 300 projects in Africa, along with the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is working on $10 billion worth of deals. Whitney.
Adam Bowler, Prosper Africa's executive chair as well as CEO of the DFC, he described it really well in the way that he does. He said, for years, we lacked the type of investment infrastructure to really be on the board. And when people would sort of say, where is the United States? Well, we didn't have the best answer, but because of the Build Act, because of Prosper Africa, we do have an answer. We're saying we're new, but we're big time, as he said, and you're going to see much, much more from us.
Martin Davis, Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa at Deloitte, told VOA he's noticed an increase in private investment initiatives from American investors and that it makes sense.
I think there was previously a lot stronger interest in the infrastructure and infrastructure assets, but I think the challenges of navigating through often sort of very challenging public sector bureaucracy has resulted in a dampening, I think, to an extent of some of the infrastructure plays. I think, however, going forward, I think U.S. multinationals remain incredibly well positioned, particularly in terms of brand recognition and the like, toward the African continent.
Sean Cairncross, CEO of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, another U.S. government initiative, is working to build a global investment platform to attract U.S. capital to Africa. Investing in African entrepreneurs, he said, just makes sense and aligns with this administration's foreign policy.
This partnership's well aligned with our key priorities, which is seeking new and innovative opportunities for blended finance. It's a priority that this administration is, like I say, 100% behind, and the interagency coordination on this is, I think, an unheralded piece of the Trump administration's foreign development push.
Whitney acknowledges that the world of investment seems abstract and complicated. So she said, here's a real-life example of how the program has worked for one Ghanaian entrepreneur.
Eugenia Akwete first started a Shea Cosmetics company, and she turned to USAID for technical assistance, as well as some market intelligence, matchmaking, and networking support. And then she also received seed capital and technical assistance from USADF, both Prosper Africa leading partners. And she attended numerous USAID-sponsored training sessions and conferences.
Today, she said, Akwete's products are available in more than 1,000 Target stores in the U.S., and on the continent, 10,000 shea nut pickers have jobs. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Food Program is increasing cash assistance to hundreds of thousands of Kenyans, urban poor, hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says Kenya has recorded 52,612 cases of coronavirus, including 964 deaths. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
COVID-19 thrives and spreads easily in crowded urban settlements and poor sanitary conditions. In Kenya's capital, Nairobi, about 60% of the population of 4.4 million live in slums, vulnerable to viral infections and contagious diseases. World Food Program spokesman Thompson Feary says an estimated 1.7 million people living in these areas are short of food and lack nutrition because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Now, with new cases that are surging across the urban centers in Kenya, we fear that many more in COVID-19 hotspot counties may need our assistance.
In response to this food and nutrition crisis, Theory says WFP is rolling out cash assistance for more than 400,000 people in Nairobi and Mombasa. He says people will receive a $40 monthly stipend. This is enough to cover up to half the food needs for an average family of four. Theory says many more people who have lost jobs and income due to the pandemic need aid. However, he notes WFP does not have the money to help them. He says the agency's $64 million emergency appeal is only 36% funded. With adequate international support, he says WFP would be able to provide food assistance to 725,000 needy people in Nairobi's informal settlements and other hotspots. However, with the amount of cash on hand, he says WFP only can reach out to the most vulnerable households. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The Confederation of African Football has set new dates for the last two matches in this year's Champions League. The semi-final second leg between Egypt's Zamalek and Raja Casablanca of Morocco will now be played on November 4th at the Cairo International Stadium. The Moroccan champions lost 1-0 to Zamalek in the first leg in Casablanca last month and are battling to meet another Egyptian side, Al Ahly, in the final. The final will be played on November 27th at the Borg Al Arab Stadium near Alexandria, with both games said to be played behind closed doors. The second leg of the semi-final had twice been postponed after a COVID-19 outbreak at the Raja Club in the run-up to the fixture. The final itself was originally set for November 6th, but has been delayed by 3 weeks after Egyptian authorities expressed concerns about the timing of the games because of parliamentary elections in Egypt. Meanwhile, CAF President Ahmed has been hospitalized after contracting COVID-19. He's spent 5 days in hospital in Cairo. The 60-year-old tested positive for COVID-19 on Friday, 2 days after flying into the Egyptian capital from Morocco, where he attended Sunday's Confederation Cup final. FIFA President Gianni Infantino, who is in self-isolation after contracting coronavirus himself last week, has reportedly written to Ahmed to express support. Ahmed's hospitalization comes in a week he announced his candidacy for a second term in office, but the same day it was reported that the Malagasy may be prevented from contesting March's elections. There are reports that Ahmed has been found to have breached various codes of ethics, with the sentencing expected to happen by the end of November. Ahmed is now set to stay in hospital until November 13th, with the registration deadline for the CAF presidential elections ending a day before. In athletics, the Boston Athletic Association announced that the 125th Boston Marathon, traditionally held on the third Monday in April, Patriots Day in Massachusetts, will now be postponed until at least the fall of 2021 due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Meanwhile, the Athens Marathon, scheduled for November 8th, has been cancelled. And world 100 meters champion Christian Coleman has been banned for 2 years after missing 3 drug tests. The 24-year-old American, who is suspended from May 14, 2020, will miss the postponed Tokyo Olympics next year. Coleman won 100 meters gold at the World Championships in Doha in 2019. His representative has confirmed the indoor 60-meter world record holder will appeal against the Athletics Integrity Unit's ruling to the Court of Arbitration for Sports. The two-time world champion, Coleman, who also won the 4x100 meters relay gold in Doha, has 80 days to file an appeal. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah. we tell them, blaze them. Look at you in that dress, girl, you dangerous like a gun. Give them you, nothing less, girl, you murder everyone. Your love is a killer. Your love is a killer. Hey, look at you.
katendwa kio na umetendwa watua janja kafendwa itajuta na sita lalama popote tusema na moyo
for you, baby. Yeah. don't beat me for you. Nearly kill me for you. Even swear me for you. Feel it a while for you. They don't beat me for you. Nearly kill me for you. Even swear me for you. Feel it a while for you. Baby, they are for you. Baby, feel it a while.
Said you better somebody give me your compassion. And if there's trouble, come you knocking pull on. And if I'm hungry, girl, you know the full on. When I've been there, don't guess you to one. You close your teeth with more book on. And the thing where I put you back come. And the thing where I want you can bring them. Girl, it's too fine, sweet, so you can't come. Too straight for what you know, get back on. Girl, you want to watch on, I'm a big time. And girl, you want to watch on, I'm a savvy big time. I just wanna let you know, you're not the number one.
They don't beat me for you. Girl, they kill me for you. Swear me for you, still it's a while for you. They don't beat me for you, they'll kill me for you. They even swear me for you, still it's a while for you. Baby, they are for you. Baby, still it's a while.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no one drinks medicine on behalf of a sick person. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.